we're going to have a little bit of a different type of talk. My title is intentionally a little bit provocative. It's Follow Your Heart or Else, The Tyranny of Feelings in Pop Music. And last year I gave a lecture on pop breakup songs. And particularly I was focusing on the victorious tone that many of them seem to have. They're motivational songs as well as being breakup songs somehow. And that was a very specific theme to be working with. And as I was listening to a lot of pop music in preparation for that lecture, I started wondering if there'd be some value in stepping back a little bit and trying to look more generally at broader themes than triumph in breakup songs. And that's sort of what I'm attempting to do tonight, is look at some more broad and sort of ubiquitous themes that are everywhere in pop music. The most general theme that I could come up with, which is, in a sense it's obvious, was the portrayal of emotions in pop music. Specifically, the authority of our feelings to guide and direct us in life. There seems to be a special primacy given to feelings, both in the broader culture, but articulated in pop music specifically. So this struck me as something worth looking into. It's very, very broad. It's a very, very broad topic. I found it to be almost too broad because it's talking about a massive cultural phenomenon, and pop music is just one of the louder expressions of that phenomenon, a manifestation sort of that cultural thing. I'm not at all an expert in pop music. I listen to the radio a bit. I listen to the exercise playlist that my wife has on her iPod. I'm exposed to this and that. I'm not at all claiming to be a connoisseur of all kinds of esoteric pop at all. To start, I want to just... I have a couple of other disclaimers in a few minutes, but we'll wait for those. I feel this is the type of lecture I feel like you need. You could spend half of the time talking about the disclaimers. Anyway, I'll try not to do that. I want to start by showing you a clip from the movie High Fidelity. I believe it's the very opening scene of the film. Hopefully this will work seamlessly. It worked a few minutes ago, so.
And now seamlessly.
Yes, exactly. Well, maybe I'll start talking. I'll just keep talking, and hopefully that will magically happen for us. I think it's safe to say that much of pop music involves a heightened emotional state. It's one of the things that I'll be talking about tonight. There's an intensity of feeling that's almost a necessity for it to be mainstream pop. These could be negative feelings. It can be sadness, regret, anger, loss, or it can be extremely positive feelings, ecstatic, joy, triumph, being intensely in love, feelings of invincibility. But it's very often the extreme ends of the spectrum. Okay. Well, let's see. Okay.
Some sort of culture of violence will take them over. Nobody worries about kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Anyway, that's it.
And that is his girlfriend about to break up with him. So that's
the opening of the movie. So I was talking about the sort of heightened emotional state that exists in a lot of pop music. It's kind of the air that pop music breathes, is this heightened emotional state. And the central importance of intense emotional experience, I think, is on the level of an assumption in a lot of pop culture today in general. It doesn't have to be articulated, it doesn't have to be talked about or even thought about. It's an assumption that intense emotional experiences are really, really, really important. Here's my list of caveats here. I'm going to tell you a couple things that I'm not going to do this evening. I'm definitely not going to offer a genre-wide critique of pop music. It's too big a topic to do that. I'm not interested in the endeavor anyway. I'm not trying to say it's all frivolous or harmful or to be viewed with suspicion. I am saying that music that is very popular is worth listening to carefully and critically. But that's not to say that on principle we should listen with hostility or condescension even. We'll talk about that a bit more later. I think there's some really, really well-written pop music. There's some badly written pop music. There's pop music which is harmless and fun. There's pop music which is destructive. And so it's such a broad category. It's hard to say any one thing about it. If I do sound a bit negative tonight, it's because I've specifically chosen songs that I think best demonstrate ideas that I find problematic. So it's not that I'm saying all pop music is a problem. Secondly, I did not actually choose the songs based on whether I like them or not. What I consider to be artistic merit, which you can take or leave, but that's not actually one of my criteria for choosing songs tonight. Again, my selection process has to do with whether the song expresses a theme that I'm trying to talk about. How good an example is it of this theme? And lastly, I have not identified a new trend in pop music. I'm also not offering a prophetic claim about the direction that pop music is headed. We're going to be listening to some fairly new songs and some older songs also. The point being, this theme of the primacy of our feelings has been around for a long time. It's not a new trend. So is it just we're using pop music as a window into understanding a broader cultural phenomenon which has been around for a long time. That's it for my caveats. I think I promised that. For my outline, just to give you a sense of where we're going, I want to talk a little bit about why we're even doing what we're doing tonight, why listen to pop music seriously. Secondly, the cultural assumption that what you feel is what you are. Thirdly, what I'm calling an exhortation. The what you feel is what you are, I would say, is on the level of a doctrine today for many people. That's the second section. The third section is to be authentic, you must follow your heart. That's sort of the exhortation that follows from the doctrine, to put it in religious terms. And then the fourth section is seeking intense emotional experiences. And then finally, a brief Christian reflection on some of these things we've been thinking about. So, first, why are we doing this at all? One of the things that occurred to me is that in many of our minds, pop music is below criticism. And I will flesh out what I mean by that. You might say, isn't this frivolous music? Isn't pop, by virtue of being commercial and mainstream, lacking in artistic value anyway? If it's not making serious statements about reality, then why are we making serious statements about pop music? What's the point? Aren't we intellectualizing something that's not really meant to be intellectualized? It's entertainment. I've wondered this at times while preparing for lectures like this. What am I doing? Many of the ideals that pop music espouses, if you want to say that, if they were written down in an essay, many of us would be quite critical of those things. We would see the folly of what was being argued, so to speak. various things would seem absurd to us about it. This is because we respect the essay as a format for intellectual engagement. But the ideals of pop music are not written down in essays. They are sung to catchy tunes. They're sung to a good beat with huge, inspiring accompaniment, which has been very carefully produced and arranged. And we hear these songs over and over and over again if we listen to the radio. So it's easy not to even notice what's being said in a pop song in a way that you would notice if you were reading an essay trying to prove something to you. Most people don't think deeply or critically about pop lyrics at all. This is the case not because we view it as above criticism, the way we would view maybe the opinion of a professor we respect. We wouldn't want to question them. Their opinion is above criticism. We don't really think critically about pop music because it's below criticism in our minds. We don't really view it as worthy of serious thought. As I said before, it's fun, it's entertainment. Too trivial a thing to influence our thinking. So what's the point in engaging our minds? And I think this attitude is actually naive. Because we view it as below criticism, we actually give it a power that it might not otherwise have over us. It's a power to affect us. It has a power to affect us in part because we're unwilling to recognize that it's influential. What we listen to, some of us, for hours every day, actually does affect us. Even if we're not intellectually accepting the ideals that it's putting forth. I'm going to play a song now. The lecture will be broken up by songs. Sometimes they'll be very clear while I'm playing you this particular song. Other times it'll just be a way of breaking up the lecture and giving you something to listen to and think about throughout. So this is a Taylor Swift song that's very, very popular and well known from a few years back, called 22.
Yeah, it feels like a perfect night to dress up like hipsters and make fun of exes. It feels like a perfect night for breakfast and midnight to fall in love with strangers. Get about the deadline. It's time.
That's just to give you a little taste. Taylor Swift, from her album Red, and I think it's a good example of a very, very typical type of thing that goes on in a lot of music, which is escapism. It's let's just get out of here and forget about all the things that are stressing us out. Let's forget about the deadline, she says, and pretend like we're 22 years old. All the while, the reason I wanted to play this, all the while sort of reveling in the conflicting emotions we have. So this amazing line where she says, we're happy, free, confused, and lonely at the same time. It's miserable and magical. I think many of us have probably experienced something like that before. But it's definitely a reveling in all of the conflicting emotions. The romance of it, being lonely and confused, and yet having some sense of camaraderie with your friends. So, we're still talking about why we're even doing what we're doing. So I'll continue. I think that pop music can be an indicator and an instructor. It can be an indicator because this is really mainstream stuff. This is stuff that millions of people listen to every day. Very, very, very popular. A song doesn't get this kind of widespread audience unless it's giving people roughly what they want to hear already. It has to resonate with attitudes that are already pretty established in society for it to be this popular, this mainstream, I would say. So mainstream pop has to be pretty much in harmony with the way people are already thinking. Because this is the case, when we listen to very popular music, it's actually a fairly good indicator as to where our culture is right now, what the attitudes are out there, how people think, very often how we think, whether we want to admit it or not. So it's an indicator of the kinds of things that appeal to people and the kinds of things that people find repulsive in our culture. It tells us what the desires are of our society, and it helps us to better understand the culture we live in. But it doesn't just do that. That's pop music kind of as an indicator. I'm also trying to argue that it's an instructor. And I've already hinted at this a little bit earlier on, but it can also have the power to form our desires. A lot of the music we listen to is powerfully recommending to us a certain way of life. And it can give us a picture of what normal is or what normal should be to us. It tells us how to feel by giving us a particular picture of what the good life is. The things we should be desiring. The kinds of things we should find beautiful. And the kinds of things we should think are stupid and unattractive and outdated and lame. And of course, it does this not by telling us anything directly through rational arguments or anything like that, the essay format again. Rather, it touches us on the level of our imaginations. It paints pictures for us that appeal to our desires, not necessarily our rational thought. And because of this, that can have a very subtle but very very real power, I would say. How often have you been sort of filled with some vague sense of longing, some desire, some sort of mounting sense of transcendence or something vague after listening to music on the radio? I know I have, and I can't necessarily point to a good reason why I'm feeling that way. The quality of the songwriting, if we listen to this pop music on the radio, the quality of the songwriting varies hugely. And what we often hear when we switch the radio on is not fresh and challenging imagery and good poetry and well-crafted songs, necessarily. Very often, it's very familiar cliches. And this is pop music, very often is dealing with cliches. Turns of phrase that have been recycled so many times that we think we know what they mean, so we don't really listen to them, and they don't even actually carry much of the meaning for us anymore, but they sort of go through our heads and we swallow them. They soak into us, but we don't really think critically about them. In a similar way, I think pop music influences us in the way that advertising does. No one really wants to admit that they're affected by advertising, but most of us are. And the less we think we're influenced, probably the more we are influenced by it. And it's just the same with pop. Even if people claim to not pay attention to the words very much, it is part of the air we breathe, and it does affect how we think. There's a Taylor Swift quote, the woman who sang the song we just listened to. This is a quote in a Time magazine article. She was referring to an event where she was signing autographs for a bunch of her fans who, after the release of her latest album, there's a whole horde of adoring fans, and the interviewer commented on how gracious and kind she was to these fans and how willing she was to sign all these autographs. And this is what she said. They're discovering the music that tells them how they are going to live their lives and how they should feel and how it's acceptable to feel. I think that's kind of exciting. And to me, that sounds really sinister. Because the power she's presuming to have is huge. But she's probably not exaggerating. That's the thing. That's the point I'm trying to make. She might be an egomaniac, but she's right, actually. She is telling people what's okay to think and how it's okay to live their lives. And she's conscious of that. So, we tend to allow pop music to tell our hearts what is good and true and beautiful, even if we actually believe something quite different with our minds. And so what I'm describing here is as true for Christians as non-Christians, I think. Anyone who's exposed to this, just the fact that you're a Christian doesn't mean you're not influenced by the culture around us. We're not in a bubble. And so this stuff does affect us. This is not a reason to stop listening to pop music, I don't think, for all of us. Obviously, some songs are probably unhelpful for some of us to listen to, but it's not a reason to stop listening to pop music. It is a reason to stop passively consuming it. It's a reason to actually engage with it carefully and with thought. Because the cliches and all of these sort of actually non-reasoned arguments we're getting through the music we listen to has power when it's not thought about critically. That's when it has power. So, one step further, and I'm getting closer to the actual topic tonight. Pop music serves an emotional purpose, I think, for many people in the world today. Pop music is often about intense emotional experiences. The songs themselves embody intense emotion in the performance or in the lyrics. But the songs are also conveyors of that emotional intensity to those who listen to it. So they seek to achieve the very emotional state for the listener that is being sung about or being expressed through the performance. So we can be drawn into the emotional world of the song. And I think we know this. Very often we actually use music in order to be drawn into the emotional world of the song. That's one of the reasons we go to it. We know a particular song will make us feel a particular way, and we're seeking that feeling. And I think this is true of all kinds of music. It's true of all kinds of literature and films. It's true of all kinds of substances. So this is not something that's unique to pop music at all. We go to these things in order to feel something that we want to feel very often. One woman commented, it was an interview with the band American Authors, and she commented, "Whenever I'm having a bad day, I listen to The Best Day of My Life by American Authors, and I always feel so much better." It's surprising to me. I'll play the song right now, and I'll see if you think that it would make you feel a whole lot better if you were really depressed about something. Anyway.
Stretch my hands out to the sky. We dance with monsters through the night. Whoa.
apparently this song was written by the band American Authors when they were really depressed with their dull and oppressive jobs, and it was inspired by the children's book Where the Wild Things Are, where you sort of slip into a dream and go off to some other reality and romp with monsters and whatnot. But it's clearly, it's a similar type of thing to the first song we listened to in that it's about escape, right? It's about reality basically sucks and I need to get away. Please don't wake me now. It's a little confusing as to what is the best day of his life. Is the dream the best day of his life, or is he going to wake up and experience the best day of his life? I'm not sure. But in any case, the song functions as, for this one woman who I quoted, whenever I'm feeling really bad, this song lifts me out of it. So we go to music for its mood-altering power very often. And it's not always in a positive sense, I don't think. We don't just listen to happy music to cheer us up or help us escape unpleasant thoughts and feelings. We do that, but that's not the only way we use music. We also listen to music in order to feel angry, sometimes. Many people do. People sometimes listen to music in order to dwell more deeply in their sadness or to relish it, or in order to intensify feelings of loneliness or victimhood or grievance. A happy pop song can help you forget about your sadness momentarily, maybe. A happy pop song might actually make you feel worse. But a sad song can help you wallow in your sadness if that's what you want. So this is just a few of the ways in which pop music can function emotionally. It has an emotional purpose in many people's lives. People listen to the music in order to feel something, or to feel anything, maybe. So, moving along to our second main point, which is the first sort of cultural assumption, which I'm calling a doctrine. What you feel is who you are. And this is a statement about identity. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of depth on the topic of identity because other people have done a lot more work on this. Dick has written a whole book on identity, and we can talk about that maybe afterwards. But in the background to much of this music, there's an assumption that our emotional experience is the core of our identity. There's an immense confusion in our culture about identity today. How are we to understand ourselves? How am I to think of me? Who am I? What makes me, me? Why is not knowing who I am so painful? Why do I long for some kind of coherence in myself and don't have it? Et cetera, et cetera. In the attempt to answer these questions, many people turn to their emotions as the answer. And the reason I think so many people in our culture turn to emotions as an answer to the question of identity is that, firstly, our emotional life is undeniably real. Whether or not what we're feeling corresponds to reality or not, that's a different issue. Sometimes we're feeling something that has nothing to do with reality, but the feeling itself is real. We're experiencing it for real. When we're in the midst of sadness or calmness or anger or relief, these feelings are the realest thing available to us, maybe. So our emotions are a powerful part of our consciousness, and it's a huge part of what it is to experience ourselves as a self. So that's one reason why I think people turn to their emotional life as a core of their identity. Another reason is that our emotional life, to some degree, makes us unique. I mean, at least it makes us feel unique. No one else is feeling exactly what I'm feeling right now in the same way. No one shares my consciousness. So perhaps this is the essence of who I am. Maybe my emotions are what distinguish me from everybody else in the world. Now I'm going to play another song
by Philip Phillips.
Dead to rights, born and raised, we are Dickens into our last days. So hold me close and I'll surrender to your arms. You know how to give and how to take. You see every hope. behind. Let your heart be next to mine. Before the flame goes out tonight, we can live until we die.
I mean, this is obviously a love song, a very passionate love song. We'll talk about some of the imagery will come up later in the lecture, I think. But the part that strikes me for now is this second verse down here, where he says, "If you listen close, you'll hear the sound of all the ghosts that bring us down. Hold on to what makes you feel. Don't let go. It's what makes you real." And so this is, I think, to me, is a pretty good articulation of what it means to have emotions be at the core of your identity. It's what you feel that makes you real. And Dick has, in his book Beyond Identity, has referred to this as new romanticism. Taking some of the ideas of old romanticism and embodying them today, new romantics are people who attempt to find their identity in their emotions. The new romantic says, "I am what I feel most strongly. That's the core of who I am." And Dick contrasts this to the new Victorians, who are more apt to find their identity in their work and their ability to create wealth and security for themselves and their families. But for the new romantic, personal emotions, a quote, "personal emotions are the highest authority and spontaneity is the holy grail." And these are not, I don't think, hard and fast categories. There's aspects of each in many people. But I think it's safe to say that when it comes to a lot of the pop music we listen to, we're functioning in a world of new romantics. New romanticism is at play here. There's not a lot of pop songs about facing life decisions in a measured and responsible way, and thinking through your options as rationally as you can, weighing consequences and considering costs and benefits and the impact to others. There's thousands upon thousands of pop songs about how the singer is feeling right now and what those feelings lead him or her to do. So, if what we feel is our closest indication of who we are, what we feel is likely to have a tremendous power and authority in our lives. And it does. So this is the second cultural phenomenon or cultural attitude, which I think is sort of the, if the last one was doctrine, this is more the application or the exhortation. How do you live out that doctrine or live in light of it? And that is, to be authentic, you must follow your heart. That's the exhortation that I think is very common in our culture today. It's one thing to claim that our emotions are at the core of our identity. That's an observation, whether it's true or false. It's another to say that that is exactly where our emotions belong, at the core. That's a moral and an ethical statement. It's a statement that has an implied should in it. So if our emotional experience should be treated as the core of who we are, this will obviously have ethical implications for us. It will impact what we should do in life, how we should live, how we should love, how we should go about making decisions. So our emotions will have an authority in our decision-making process that is really foremost. The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, this is him here. I'm going to be referring to Taylor quite a bit. Don't confuse him with Taylor Swift, who we've also talked about early on. I was thinking of having a picture of both of them side by side, just so you guys could keep it straight. But I think you'll probably be okay. All the following thoughts are from Charles Taylor, not Taylor Swift. More from Taylor Swift later. But he's a Canadian philosopher who's written a lot of very helpful things, particularly on authenticity. There's a book called The Ethics of Authenticity. And he claims that in contemporary culture, what authenticity has come to mean is the moral ideal to be true to yourself. And what does he mean by moral ideal? A moral ideal is a picture of what a better or higher mode of life would be, where better and higher are defined not in terms of what we happen to desire or need, but offer a standard of what we ought to desire. So it's the ought that makes it a moral ideal. So human beings ought to be true to themselves. This is the cultural moral ideal of authenticity, he claims. And he insists that it's not just a smokescreen for narcissism or a means of justifying selfish behavior. He dismisses that idea. It's not a lame excuse made by people in the me generation to pursue their own desires no matter what. He says, no, it's much more than that. When people say, be true to yourself, it is really a moral assertion, something people really think they and other people should do and would be wrong not to do. He writes again, what we need to understand here is the moral force behind notions of self-fulfillment. Talk of permissiveness misses the point. Moral laxity there is, and our age is not alone in this. What we need to explain is what is peculiar to our time. It's not just that people sacrifice their love relationships and the care of their children to pursue their careers. Something like this has perhaps always existed. The point is that today many people feel called to do this. They feel they ought to do this. Feel their lives would be somehow wasted or unfulfilled if they didn't do it. So in other words, I think what he's saying is that maybe 100 years ago or more, someone might have neglected their family for their work, but their motivations for doing it might have been greed or self-importance or idolatry of work or competition. All things that are generally viewed as vices, or would have been viewed as vices then, something that in their better moments they might have repented from. But today, Taylor is arguing, people do the very same things, but are convinced that they are really doing the right thing. The noble thing. It's not construed as a moral shortcoming, it's the heroic choice. Being strong and courageous enough to be true to yourself, whatever the cost. And I don't have an exact quote from this, but I remember hearing Meryl Streep say something like this, actually, about how she put her career before her children and how courageous a thing that was and how they understood that for her to be happy, for her to be a good mother, they had to allow her to really put her career first. And that was not a confession, that was not an apology, that was not in no way was that something that she was regretting. And yet, there's a strange irony in this, and I think Charles Taylor points this out. The moral ideal to be true to yourself can be so strong in a culture which has largely accepted moral relativism as self-evident. A culture in which it's not okay to tell anyone else how they should live. To make universal assertions about how people should behave is off-limits today, Taylor says. He writes, a liberal society must be neutral on questions of what constitutes the good life. The good life is what each individual seeks in his or her own way. And yet, the statement that people should be true to themselves is exactly this kind of moral universal statement. It's not a neutral statement about what constitutes the good life. It's telling us the road we must take to the good life. So relativism and universal moral ideals don't really mix, even though relativism is a universal moral ideal. But anyway, Taylor describes this dilemma as resulting in an inarticulate debate. I'm going to turn the lights. I'm afraid I didn't really turn the lights. He says that what follows is an inarticulate debate. The virtue of being true to yourself is strongly held in our culture, but it can never be articulately defended in the present relativistic climate, where we can't say to anyone else how they should live. And so the ideal sinks to the level of an axiom, something one doesn't challenge but also never expounds. Its opponents slight it, and its friends can't speak of it. The whole debate conspires to put it into the shade, to render it invisible. And so Taylor's lamenting the fact that a clear articulation of this moral ideal isn't taking place in the public square. And so it's sort of beyond clear critique, and it's also beyond clear defense. I would say, and this is something that suddenly struck me as I was reading this, I would say that one of the areas in our culture that comes closest to articulating the moral ideal of authenticity is pop music. And pop music sort of gets away with it more than any other sphere in our culture today. It gets away with proclaiming the moral ideal of authenticity, which in other contexts would come across as preachy. But in the context of pop, it can be sung from the rooftops. It can be proclaimed. And one of the reasons is what we were talking about before, is the fact that so much of pop music is below criticism. We don't think of it as something that we need to criticize. And so it can proclaim all kinds of things that if we wrote down in an essay, would be written off. So, not many people, I would say, listen to pop music seriously enough to say things like this. Wait a minute. I feel like Katy Perry is preaching at me about how I should live my life. Many people listen to Katy Perry, but that's not a common response. How is it that the band Maroon 5 thinks that they can tell me how to make my decisions about my love life? They do all the time, but I don't think many people say that. Think of it in that term. Anyway, what so much pop preaches, either directly or indirectly, can be summed up by the phrase, follow your heart. That's where I've got my title tonight. Your feelings in every moment of your life are to be attended to with the utmost respect and reverence, and they're to be obeyed. Another way of saying this is that you should allow your emotions and your intuitions to guide you in every moment. If you Google follow your heart, there's a rich world out there of greeting cards, and I'll just read a couple of these. The cost of not following your heart is spending the rest of your life wishing you had. Follow your heart, because if you always trust your mind, you'll always act on logic, and logic doesn't always lead to happiness. The implication being, if you just follow your heart, it always will lead to happiness. That's what's implied there. Break the rules, stand apart, ignore your head, and follow your heart. That's Paula Abdul. Don't think too much. You'll think your whole life away. Just stop, close your eyes, and follow your heart. I guarantee you it knows the way. There's no regrets in following your heart. At one point in your life, you'll be able to look back, and it'll all make sense. Have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. That's Steve Jobs. Sometimes you have to follow your heart no matter what the consequences. That's a small selection. There was two slightly dissenting opinions that I found among the sort of greeting cards, and they were this. For all this accolades and celebrated recognition as sound guidance, I have personally noticed that sometimes follow your heart is really bad advice. And follow your heart, but don't forget to take your brain with you. Anyway, those are the only two, like, Debbie Downers among all of the now, assuming that all of these sentiments are true, let's for a moment assume that they're true. What can we learn? What can we learn from them? What are they telling us? The heart, which we think of, I think, as the seat of our emotional life, it's what we mean when we say the heart, the source of our intuition, the source of our feelings. Your heart is your surest guide. If you follow it, you can never really go wrong. It is impossible to make the wrong decision if you simply act on what you feel most deeply. because what you feel most deeply is the real you. That's the real you. And that's the doctrine that I was talking about before, about identity. Again and again, this command to follow your heart is contrasted with the negative alternatives, right? To not follow your heart, you know, watch out. To not follow your heart is to be a slave to your head, your rational mind. And that's the part of you that never permits you to have any fun. That's the part of you that always opts for prudence and safety over adventure and passion. To not follow your heart is to miss out on what would have been your real life. Like, that's an amazing claim, sort of a nonsensical claim to me. But to not follow your heart, you'll miss out on what would have been your real life. The life you deserve or owe yourself. The real life is the one you can only reach by following your heart. And this is very much, it ties in with this idea of self-actualization. So we all of us are on a journey to reach our fullest potential, and that journey is really defined by us, and what our fullest potential is also defined by us. And everything else should be sacrificed to that ideal, to find your best self. To not follow your heart would be to miss out on happiness itself, and it would be condemned to a state of constant regret. So this is what we're getting at. We know the cost of not following your heart is spending the rest of your life wishing you had. That's a life of regret. And we'll talk about regret more later. To not follow your heart usually means being controlled by other people's expectations of you, fulfilling other people's dreams, allowing yourself to be a tool for someone else's ends. And it's something you should break free from as soon as possible. So all of this, all of these negative alternatives of not, you know, not following your heart is what our culture would call inauthenticity, a failure to be authentic. These are examples of being untrue to yourself. And in our culture, these are very compelling images of failure. I think if we think about images of success and images of failure, a lot of this that's implied here about not following your heart, those are compelling images of failure, of moral failure even. You're wasting your life. The only way to be authentic is to be true to your emotions and follow your heart in every moment, wherever it takes you. That's the only thing that actually makes you real. Let's remember the Philip Phillips song we listened to a few minutes ago. That's what makes you real. Hold on to what you feel. My hunch is that many a marriage has fallen apart, and many a spouse has been cheated on because of this call to be true to your feelings as an absolute. Follow your heart. Follow your heart. And I think there's a tyranny to this, and that's why this lecture is about a tyranny. It's presented to us as the only real option for an honest person. You must allow your emotions to be your guide, otherwise you're not real, you're fake. What kind of guide are we actually allowing to lead us? That's my question for tonight. What kind of authority are we actually submitting to here? What does life really look like when we do this, when we blindly follow the prompting of our feelings? This next song is one by Ben Folds Five. This came out when I was in college. It's a bit older, mid-90s, something like that. Late 90s. I think it's a great song, but it communicates exactly the type of thing I'm trying to get at.
Summer down. I want that down.
It's a really interesting song. It reminds me of Penny Lane by the Beatles at the various times. There's a weird 1970s TV show type of bridge there with the horns and the string. It's an interesting song. Very, very thoughtfully written, I think. Ben Folds seems sort of resigned to the fact that he has to follow whatever his heart dictates. This is the repeated line there. Which actually leads to an unstable, erratic, indecisive, and sad life. But so be it. It also leads to a selfish life that deeply hurts other people, but so be it. So there's sort of a wistful resignation to what I would call the tyranny of his heart. It's reminiscent of a comment that Woody Allen made, where he said, "The heart knows what the heart wants." And what he was referring to is why he busted up his marriage by having an affair with his adopted daughter. And when he was asked, why did he do this? He said, "The heart knows what the heart wants." It's as if to say the affair was just going to happen. Who am I to question my heart? So the line in the Ben Folds song we just listened to, "All I know is I've got to be where my heart says I ought to be. It often makes no sense. In fact, I never understand these things I feel. I love you. Goodbye." He doesn't understand his feelings at all. They make no sense to him, and yet he does not question their total authority in his decision-making process. So he literally just moved to LA to this apartment, has all his bags, and he gets this vague, intuitive misgiving that's attached to some sort of nostalgia for the East Coast. Maybe it's the fall and the leaves are falling, and he's gone. He goes back down the stairs and drives away. So, and then there's the sort of pseudo-sensitive remark, don't change your plans for me, right? Pseudo-sensitive, he's trying to sound sensitive there, but actually what he's really saying is, I'm done, don't follow me. I really don't want you in my life anymore. So, it gets more complicated, I think, because how we feel is so important. It's important to us that we feel a lot. I'm sort of moving towards the next section here. With my emotions at the core of my identity, for me to feel like I have an identity, I will need to have intense emotional experiences regularly. It's the intensity of our feelings that make us feel real to ourselves. I'm saying us, I think, thankfully, not all of us have this, but I'm wanting to identify with this a little bit. I'm not just talking about those people out there. If I am emotionally flat or even emotionally stable, I feel like I'm not making contact with reality, and I'm not even sure who I am. And so there's an active seeking after intense emotional experiences. This is section 4 here. Intense emotions become something for us to achieve. Intense positive emotions, but also intense negative emotions. People seek out the most intense experiences in order to legitimize their existence, I think, which otherwise can feel illegitimate, in order to justify to themselves why they're still breathing. I think there's many contributing factors, I think, that are very sad in the culture we live in right now. I mean, people who struggle with depression, very often it's an overwhelming sense of unreality of life and meaninglessness of life. People who struggle with boredom, what Richard Winter has called the boredom epidemic in our country, an inability to find interest in anything around us. The phenomenon that so many people describe of feeling numb towards everything, numb to the world, feeling disconnected and unaffected by everything around them. This is the backdrop to why so many people turn to intense emotional experiences. Because emotional experience can provide a temporary escape. Escaping sadness, escaping boredom, restlessness, anxiety. A lot of songs are basically about escaping painful reality through the intense experience. But that's not all that's going on. I think there's also a striving forward towards something real, anything real at all. And it's actually one of the aspects of the phenomenon of self-harm, people who hurt themselves, self-mutilation, cutting. For many people, it's worth hurting themselves to feel that something is real. Not that that's the only thing going on, but that's one of the aspects of it. This is one of the reasons why people actually cut themselves, because pain is undeniably real. And a lot of songs, in one way or another, actually say this or refer to this. The famous song "Hurt" by Nine Inch Nails, it was famously covered by Johnny Cash a number of years later. But the very first verse in the song says, "I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything." So this is more about, it was about drug use, not just self-mutilation, but it's getting at something similar. A more recent song by One Republic, I'm not going to play, just for the sake of time, I'm not going to play all these songs, but there's this refrain in this song called "Counting Stars," which says, "Everything that kills me makes me feel alive." And then later on, "Everything that drowns me makes me want to fly." And then, I'm embarrassed to mention the Goo Goo Dolls. Goo Goo Dolls? Anyway, Joshua? Goo Goo Dolls? Okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah. "When everything feels like the movies, you bleed just to know you're alive." So that's a good description of life not feeling real to you. Everything just feels like the movies. My real experiences feel like I'm just watching a screen. It's not real. So I make myself bleed to know that I'm actually alive and to legitimize the fact that I'm still breathing to myself. So these lyrics are about physical pain that's self-inflicted in order to feel something real. Emotional pain can function in the same way, I think. Wallowing in emotional pain and heartache can achieve something like the same sense of reality. Something is real, at least. I'm going to play the first verse of a song. I'm not going to play the whole song for the sake of time. But this is a song by the band Passenger. It's a British band. This is from 2012. Those were the quotes I just gave you.
Thank you. winds burn low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go.
Sorry. That line happens over and over and over again in the song. You get the basic idea. Let her go. This song, to me anyway, seems to wallow in sadness. As if there is something really precious and poetic about the pain you feel after you dump your girlfriend. More specifically, what the refrain implies, only know you love her when you let her go, is that you can only really value good things after you lose them or throw them away. Which is to say that we see most clearly when we are bereaved. When it's too late and the good thing is gone, that's when we are in touch with reality. That's when we can see what things are worth. If you have a good relationship, you can't really know how you feel about the other person and be thankful while you have them. You have to say goodbye to know that. So we're condemned to be jerks and then regret it. And that's where we exist. And I think it's telling us this as if it's a universal truth about people. He doesn't say, I only knew I loved her when I let her go. It's saying, you only know you love her when you let her go, and you let her go. So he's talking to you, all of you. This is how people behave. This is how we think. It seems to me that this is actually, this song gets under my skin, I'm sorry if it's too obvious, but part of it is his vocal performance. But it seems to me that it's an anthem against thankfulness. We are inevitably blind to the blessings we have when we have them. All we can do is regret their loss. So discontentment is tragic, but it's unavoidable, and that's the only way we can ever value anything that we in the world is by losing it. So, in a sense, emotional pain here is the guide. It's the boss. Sadness gets to define reality, gets to define what things are worth. How do I know I love someone unless I can feel the pain of their loss? Another song here, this is getting a little more intense, I'm going to show you a video, hopefully it'll work, from Taylor Swift's latest album, it's called Blank Space.
And we'll see how that goes. This has become a very, very popular...
I can read you like a magazine. And it's funny, I want
I am a nightmare dressed like a daydream. So it's gonna be forever.
Give you a minute to recover, sorry. This song is really about power. I mean, the video communicates it very well. Lovers are something to consume. There's a blank space. You can put anyone's name there. There's a line which I think many people, myself included, thought was, gotta love the Starbucks lovers.
Yeah.
It actually, I've got a long list of ex-lovers. That's the... She's even commented on this, you know, haha, you know, I don't say Starbucks in the song, I've got a long list of ex-lovers. It sounds exactly like she's saying Starbucks. I'm wondering whether it's... That was a really interesting line for a while, and then I was like, oh. Starbucks lovers, what is that? Man, amazing. Anyway, a long list of ex-lovers is what she says. And the people are interchangeable. There's this hallway with all these portraits of different men that have had their faces gouged out or different things, and of course she does that to a guy. And at the very end of the song, a new guy at the door, right? So it's about her power to do that. And remember, this is the album in which he's signing autographs and is so excited that people are hearing the music that tells them how it's okay to feel and live, right? This is how it's okay to feel and live. But in addition to power, it's also about rushing into as intense a relationship as possible, as quickly as possible, as recklessly as possible, knowing that it's all going to explode. It's going to last forever. Nobody really knows. Nobody really thinks it's going to last forever. Or it's going to go down in flames. It'll leave you with a nasty scar. That's one of the lines. She's anticipating and actually thriving on the emotional chaos that will cause. It's all a game. You love the game. I love the players. You love the game. But it's a game that ends with flames and death and ruined cars. This is a guy who's lying dead by his, whatever, the Jaguar, I think.
Why is he dead?
Presumably she killed him. But somehow, this is how we like it, right? We're addicted to the pain. And then there's the bridge where she says, boys only want love if it's torture. And so this is another aspect of what I'm getting at. Seeking after chaos and emotional pain, both as a way of experiencing power, but also a way of experiencing our identity and being real to ourselves. How else does one go about seeking intense emotional experiences other than breaking up with lovers? And I think here I'm moving into sort of a world of cliches. Again, we were talking about cliches earlier, and there are so many recurring cliches in pop music, and one of them is losing control. I call it the ethic of losing control, because control is presented as something that one should lose. How many songs have you heard in which the concept of these, or this concept, or even those exact words were proclaimed? Let's lose control. I want to lose control. I say we lose control. One of my earliest memories of pop music was in the 80s listening to the Pointer Sisters, where they sing, "I'm so excited and I just can't hide it. I'm about to lose control and I think I like it." So it's been around for a long time. Lose control. Any other examples you have out there is great. You can bring them to my attention in the discussion. Predictably, I think the exhortation to lose control is often made in the context of doing drugs or having sex. I think those are two stereotypical themes in a lot of music. It's actually the exhortation to lose control, I think, very often is a tool to manipulate someone to have sex. You want your potential partner to lose control. Anyway, sex and drugs are two of the most potent avenues for losing control and having intense experiences. And like I said, losing control is presented almost as a moral imperative. We'd better lose control because it's the only way to achieve the heightened emotional experience that we need in order to feel alive and know we're real. So losing control has to do with surrendering to whatever is happening in the moment and letting it take you wherever it will, in order to fully experience the feelings. And we've already heard several songs that use fire imagery as the imagery for loss of control. A fire that can start small and then get out of control, and you can even fan it and make it get out of control if you really want. So, the Philip Phillips song, "Turn My Soul Into a Raging Fire." The band Fun has this line where they say, "Tonight we are young, so let's light the world on fire. We can burn brighter than the sun." Fire imagery is a very, for whatever reason, popular one for loss of control. But to really lose control, you have to silence some of the voices that you have in your head. Voices that might encourage you to stay in control. But most people, not all people, but many people, at least sometimes, have a voice of prudence in their mind that says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, take it easy. Slow down. Keep your head. Use your better judgment. Don't let things get out of control." It's a voice that might speak to us about the consequences of what we're doing. But losing control usually means silencing or disabling this voice, right? And here we come, I think, to another common cliche, which is forgetting about tomorrow. How many times have you heard these words? "Let's forget about tomorrow. Don't think about tomorrow. I'm going to live like tomorrow doesn't exist." That's from a song we'll listen to later. The song 22 we listened to in the very beginning by Taylor Swift, "Tonight's the night we forget about the deadlines." That's just another way of saying let's not think about tomorrow. I'm going to quote a country song now, I'm sorry. One of the more popular country songs of the past 30 years, a song named "Reckless" by Alabama. And this is something I experienced on many a carpool to high school. The guy who drove me was really into country, so I was exposed to lots and lots of it. Some of it I liked. Anyway, so "I could care less where it leads us. Love is reckless. Let's get reckless tonight." So "I could care less where it leads us." That's about not thinking about tomorrow, not wanting to think about tomorrow. In other words, to fully experience the feelings of the moment, you have to actively avoid thoughts about the future. Another cliche, no regrets. No regrets, I think, in two senses sometimes. Number one, we're not supposed to regret anything that we've already done. Don't let the past, regrets about the past, ruin the moment. Don't think about the past at all, actually. The song "Let It Go," the epic Disney song from the movie Frozen, the character Elsa proclaims this from the top of a mountain. I'm never going back. The past is in the past. So, you know, forget about everything that's happened. It no longer has any sway or pull on your life. But the past is in the past. If we start to think seriously about past mistakes, we're much less likely to relinquish control in the minute, right? We're not really surrendering to the moment. So that's the first aspect of no regrets. Don't regret anything that you've already done in the past. The second reason, or the second meaning of no regrets, don't for a moment consider whether you might have regrets tomorrow for what you're doing right now. That's the other aspect. No regrets. Don't think about regrets. Remember, we've already forgotten about tomorrow. And so, don't begin to wonder whether you might regret what you're doing right now, tomorrow. Katy Perry wrote a song called Teenage Dream in 2010. Well, she didn't write it, I don't think. It was written by a number of people. Which is, I'm not going to play for you. It's another one of those songs that you sort of want to take behind the barn and smack around the song. Not Katy Perry, the song. But anyway, there's a verse here that says, let's go all the way tonight, no regrets, just love. This is actually the chorus. Let's go all the way tonight, no regrets, just love. We can dance until we die. You and I will be young forever. You make me feel like I'm living a teenage dream. The way you turn me on, I can't sleep. Let's run away and don't ever look back. Don't ever look back. So this is just basically about, you know, let's just go have sex and not think about anything else. We're going to be young forever. I'm living a teenage dream. I'll be young forever. Don't ever look back. No regrets. So, and this also is music. Just the sobering thing is that this is music that is shamelessly marketed to preteen girls. Katy Perry, dancing around with her pink hair. Yay! You know, but it's about going and having sex in a motel with some guy, right? So, we see another cliche in this song, I think, that's very common. We'll be young forever. In other words, what we have in this moment right now is going to last. Or at least we should act right now as if it's going to last forever. And that's another important ingredient to losing control. If I stop believing that I'm going to be young forever and reflect on the fact that I'm going to get old, I'm actually even going to be one day older tomorrow. I have to deal with consequences. I have to start thinking about how I'm going to deal with what I'm doing now. And the ethic of losing control loses some of its mystique when we think about getting old, or even tomorrow. So I think we can see what's happening with all of these cliches. They're kind of compounding. They're all time-related. They're all about excluding any consideration for anything except the present moment. All about getting lost in the moment and surrendering to the moment. Thoughts about the past are excluded, no regrets. Thoughts about the future are excluded. Don't think about tomorrow. We'll be young forever. All thoughts that inhibit you from feeling right now. Lessons from the past and concerns about the future signify a failure to surrender, a failure to let go, a failure to lose control, a failure to be reckless, which is what the moment demands. All of which it's understood to be super lame. You know, don't do that. You aren't being authentic to the emotional moment. You're inhibited, and you're missing out on what's most real. Are you even alive? Do you even have an identity? Are you even in contact with anything real at all? Does your life mean anything? Or are you hopelessly controlled by other people's expectations of you? And again, I think this is an example of the tyranny. It's an expectation that you must lose control and surrender to the moment. Because if you don't, you're prudish and repressed and a loser, and you're controlled by fears of disapproval. You don't know how to live. Your life is going to pass you by. And I want to respond, who says my feelings have to be my only guide? And I think it's a tyranny that needs a revolution. I think, if you think of it in political terms. And so I'm moving now to just some Christian reflections on a lot of the ideas we've been talking about. I'm sort of going to move through the themes step by step and just attempt to bring some biblical thinking to it. The purpose of all my ranting tonight is not to convince you that emotions are unimportant or frivolous. that would be the wrong impression if you leave tonight thinking, oh, this guy thinks emotions are insignificant and stupid. I'm not trying to say they're always harmful or they're always deceptive or that they're to be distrusted. I think our emotions are a very, very important part of how God has made us. Our emotions are an important part of what it is to be a human being. God has made us with a capacity to experience things like joy and excitement and fear and anger and sadness.
That last song, we got a boy speaking to a girl or a girl speaking to a boy?
Which song?
The last one.
The last one we listened to? The kid, oh, it's a girl speaking to a boy. So the Christian, I think, is neither called to despise his or her emotions or to disqualify them or to pretend they don't exist. And I think a lot of, you know, depending on what kind of context you've grown up in, sometimes Christian communities do behave in this way or sort of preach this kind of idea that your emotions are just on principle not to be trusted. And what really matters is your rational, cerebral assent to true things. That's all. And I'm not trying to say that either. The Christian, I think, is called not to give their emotions godlike status. So here I'm just going to walk through some of the claims I was making earlier and trying to say in what way are they true or untrue from a Christian angle here. So what about the whole question of identity? The claim that you are what you feel. Our identity is not something we need to construct from rich and exciting emotional experiences. Our emotions are a part of who we are, which means that they're too small a thing to define the whole of who we are. And this is actually the same with any number of different things that we choose to place at the core of our identity. They're not big enough to define the whole of what we are. Being a human being is too big and glorious a thing to have our identity defined by some aspect of our humanity, like our emotions or our sexuality or whatever it is. Instead, our identity is to be found in the fact that we're made in the image of God, who created all things, and we are of tremendous value. Our existence is validated because of the one who decided we should exist and said we are in his image. We've also been forgiven and adopted into God's family through the work of Christ. And so we are completely acceptable to God, acceptable to the only one whose opinion ultimately matters. We're treasured by God, not just acceptable, but treasured by God. And this is our identity, the fact that we are made by God, valued and treasured by Him, and utterly forgiven and accepted. And it's something... If you think about the difference between this as your source of identity and all the other things we've been talking about tonight, it is a world of difference. It's something solid and unalterable. Even as our emotions take ups and downs and take us all over the place, or even if we're totally flat emotionally and aren't feeling anything at all, our identity isn't called into question. Christian identity is something given to us, not something we construct or fail to construct for ourselves. And this means that actually our identity is in a place of real security. It's secure. And actually there's no security at all in an identity that's formed around our emotions, if you think about it. Secondly, what about the whole question of authenticity? To be authentic, you have to be authentic to something. You're authentic in relation to something else. And this is, again, borrowing from some of Charles Taylor's thinking. Problem is, I think, to what are we being authentic when we obey our emotions? So it's all very well to say, follow your heart, be true to yourself, follow your emotions. But to what are we being authentic, exactly? When we think of being true to ourselves, what exactly are we being true to? To be true to your emotions is not being true to any one thing. Even if we want to believe that it is. Our emotions can be all over the place, even in one day. They can change if my blood sugar is low. They can change if I need a nap. My emotional life is impacted by all kinds of different things. I can, this is just a silly example, but I could be driving down the highway on a beautiful morning with no traffic, on my way to see a great friend, listening to my favorite piece of music, and I can be really overwhelmed with feelings of well-being, peace, and serenity. My heart moves me to say thank you to God. I just feel so grateful and at peace and serene, and all things are well. And I round the corner of the road and I come to a traffic jam. There's an accident up ahead. Suddenly I'm in a very complex, shifting, uncertain, and irritating context. Someone cuts me off, I have to jam on the brakes, and I, you know, my heart prompts me to lash out at this person and I curse them. In both situations, I've acted authentically, in that I obeyed the promptings of my heart. But who am I? And what is my heart? Which is it? Am I a serene, contented, and thankful person, or am I a deeply irritable person who flies off the handle the second he's inconvenienced? Like, who am I? If I'm looking for my identity by following my heart, what is it that I'm being authentic to? Following my heart faithfully in this context has led me to disintegration because my heart is divided. It always has been. I cannot be authentic to a divided self, which is what I am. The famous quote that Dick reminded me of recently, which I was thankful for, is by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian writer. He says, "If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart?" And this is true, I think theologically, as Christians we can say this is true because we're sinners. And the fall of humanity, this fall of humanity, Adam and Eve rebelling against God and thinking they can define what is moral, this fall affects us every single day. It affects us in every part of our lives, including our emotions. So my emotions sometimes correspond with reality, and they're in line with what I know to be true sometimes. And sometimes they have very little connection to reality, and they actually are telling me lies. How can I follow both? How can I be true to both? How can I be true to the good and the evil that I find in my own heart? Okay. Thirdly, what about following your heart? What does that mean? We're supposed to acknowledge and attend to our emotions, I think, because they are real. We're supposed to take them seriously. Very often they indicate something real that we need to attend to. They're not just nothing. Why am I so angry right now? Well, it's a good question to ask if you're angry. Why am I? Don't just ignore it. But the Christian faith gives us, I think, a wonderful freedom to question our emotions. Not that we'll always find that they're wrong, but we have the freedom to question our emotions. They're not silly and insignificant, but neither are they infallible. They can be spoken to. If they can be spoken to, that means that we have not silenced all the other voices in our lives. You think of what losing control, we were talking about a minute ago, losing control involves silencing all these voices of prudence. Well, I think the Bible teaches us in all kinds of different ways and places that those voices don't have to be silenced. We actually have the freedom to speak to our emotions. Part of the Christian life, I think, is cultivating in ourselves an alternative voice to the raw, unfiltered emotions that we experience, which are changing all the time. The alternative voice can ask questions like, why do I feel the way I do right now? Do I have good reasons to feel the way I do? Does what I'm feeling correspond to the truth? Does it partially correspond to the truth? Does it correspond to nothing true? One example in my own life, I think, is that sometimes when I feel really low and sad and angry, it's not a result of anything having really gone wrong out there or in my life. It may be because I'm just feeling inadequate because I'm comparing myself to someone else, and their gifts seem to overshadow my gifts. And rather than celebrating what God has done for them, I get sulky and resentful and discouraged about my own gifts. Now, am I called by God to honor these emotions and give them legitimacy? No. You know, I'm supposed to tell myself to shut up, right? But I can only do that if there are other voices that haven't been silenced, and other voices that actually have something like the authority that my emotions have, or more authority even. The great English preacher, or I guess he's Welsh, Martin Lloyd-Jones. Martin Lloyd-Jones? One of the very, very helpful things he said was we need to cultivate the ability to listen to talk to ourselves, not just listen to ourselves. He refers to Psalm 42, which says, "Why, my soul, are you downcast? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God." So that's a very, very different thing to do than just swallowing and accepting and legitimizing whatever the tape happens to be playing in my head right now, whatever raw emotional junk is going on in my head right now. He's saying in faithfulness to God, as the psalmist does, we need to stop ourselves and speak to that with something that we know is true and that doesn't change constantly like our emotional state does. So he's speaking to his soul here. Soul, why are you downcast? Why so disturbed within me? He's acknowledging that his emotions are real. He's not saying, soul, you're not downcast. He's saying, soul, why are you downcast? And then he speaks to his soul saying, put your hope in God. Renew your faith and hope in this thing that you know is really true and that doesn't change. And I think there's a freedom in this. This to me sounds like freedom compared to the tyranny of following your heart no matter where it leads you and what it tells you to do. Particularly the Ben Folds 5 song, it really, the impact that it had on me today as I was listening to it again, like, this is slavery. This is being a slave to wherever your stupid emotions decide to take you and just obeying them no matter what. No matter what kind of pain it causes other people, no matter what kind of pain it causes you. And this biblical concept of speaking to yourself, speaking to your soul with a critical voice, is freedom. And so I'm going to move on now to a fourth point. What about seeking intense emotional experiences? What about that? First of all, I think people seek after intense emotional experiences because we were made to relate to God. You think of the passage in the third chapter of Ecclesiastes. He has also set eternity in the human heart. We have a longing for contact with transcendence somehow. We long to be in touch with transcendence, in touch with God. I think very often our seeking after intense experiences has something like this at the root of it. We want to be in touch with something that's bigger and more significant and has more meaning than just our bored lives. So this is a deeply human impulse. I think it's how God has made us. But it's also obviously a desire that gets misdirected in all kinds of ways. The Bible actually does not encourage us to manufacture our emotional states. We are called to respond with our emotions appropriately to whatever circumstance God places us in. So our feelings are meant to correspond truly to our circumstances and truly to what God has told us is true. It's okay to be sad when we have experienced brokenness and loss. The Bible is full of laments to God. This is okay to express this. It is a very real part of what it is to live in the world that's broken. It's also deeply appropriate to feel gratitude to God for His promises, which never change. I think very often an appropriate emotional response might be rejoicing with those who rejoice and mourning with those who mourn. It's one of the things that Paul exhorts us to do. Respond emotionally appropriately to the moment. If you're with someone who's lost a child, mourn. If you're with someone who's just gotten a new and wonderful job, rejoice with them. It's an aspect of our love for other people. It's not just about our internal emotional life. But my point is, our job is never to manufacture or seek certain emotions for ourselves in order to have them, for their own sake. And I think this is what sentimentality is. This is what, I want to feel this for the sake of feeling it, not because it necessarily corresponds to anything real at all in the world. We are actually free to not waste our time doing that. Because our identity is not to be found in our emotions. It's to be found in God. But that, really, I mean, this is something I'm not going to talk about at all tonight because there's not really time, but Christians and the church, and particularly in the context of worship, are very guilty of this, I think, of, you know, worship is about achieving an emotional experience. And how do I know I've really worshiped God unless I've had my emotional experience? And that's actually not what worship is in the Bible. But we can talk about that later if you want. What about losing control? Intentionally losing control is not actually something that the Bible encourages us to do either. It's not one of the fruit of the Spirit to lose control. The Bible teaches us, first of all, that God is in control and that we can actually rest in that reality. We can put our hope and trust in Him fully. But this does not mean... an aspect of this is that we're not supposed to pretend that we are in absolute control of the world around us and even in our own lives. Everything we have is God's. It's all His. We need to submit to that reality. But this God, I think also, and this seems like a paradox, but our God calls us to imitate Him in various ways. And one of that is to be responsible in the world, to act responsibly. And that's what the biblical concept of stewardship is about. To responsibly care for the things that God has loaned to us and put under our care, including our own bodies, our minds, our intellect, our emotions, each other, the natural world, everything. We're called to be alert and watchful people and to exercise our dominion, the level of control that God has given us. It's not absolute, obviously, but it is appropriate to who we are as creatures. And all this is about having an appropriate level of control in our lives and not abandoning that and relinquishing that. So I do think Christians are called to live in the present moment, not by losing control of ourselves and not in order to achieve some heightened emotion, but rather we live in the moment because that's the moment that God has given us. That's the only moment our dominion actually can be exercised. The present moment is the only moment in which we can care for other people. It's within our power to do that. In Christ, I think we're given a freedom in the present moment in that we can think about the past and think about the future without being dominated by either regrets in the past or crushed by fears in the future. So we live in the present moment, but we don't have to forget that the future and the past exist. We're actually called to remember lots of things. And what about the role of regrets? This is something that is really interesting to me, and I want to think about it more. But I was reading in 2 Corinthians not too long ago, and I came across something that seems to me like an example of emotions functioning properly, emotions functioning well. And this is drawing to a close here. This is almost my last point. And this is Paul referring to a previous letter in which he rebuked the Corinthians. He says, "Even if I caused you sorrow by my letter, I do not regret it, though I did regret it. I see that my letter hurt you, but only for a little while. Yet now I am happy, not because you were made sorry, but because your sorrow led you to repentance. For you became sorrowful as God intended, and so were not harmed in any way by us. Godly sorrow brings repentance that leads to salvation and leaves no regret. But worldly sorrow brings death. See what this godly sorrow has produced in you. What earnestness, what eagerness to clear yourselves, what indignation, what alarm, what longing, what concern, what readiness to see justice done." So, first of all, Paul is talking about people feeling sorrow for their own sin. He's not claiming that this is the only legitimate sorrow that we should feel. There's lots of reasons to feel sorrow. But in this case, it's remorseful sorrow for sin. And he calls it godly sorrow. A guy used to be a pastor of mine, a good friend, preached a whole sermon on basically this concept, godly sorrow, but he called it holy discontent. There's something, a discontent which is actually holy and from God. What are the characteristics of godly sorrow? Godly sorrow is not just gratuitous emotion. It's not emotion in a vacuum. It's not emotion that we feel for the sake of feeling something. It's an appropriate response to something that was true, that really happened. The Corinthians had done wrong and they felt convicted of it. So their emotions correspond to events that really did warrant their sorrow. Godly sorrow is not something to avoid at all costs, because being happy is our main priority. That's what having no regrets often means today, and often means in a lot of these pop songs. But neither is it a kind of sorrow that we have to savor and wallow in order to feel like we're really alive. That's not nothing like that, what he's describing. Paul is saying there is a redemptive purpose to God's sorrow, to godly sorrow, sorry, if it leads to repentance. So sadness is not really good in and of itself. Sorrow and regret are not a place to stay and pitch our tent. Remorse by itself is in no way pleasing to God. He has no interest in us feeling really bad about what we've done if that's all we do. Sorrow is only godly sorrow if it moves us to ask for forgiveness and then repent, which means to literally stop going in the direction we're going and turn around and go in the other direction, towards God again. So it implies change, willingness, openness to change. In other words, remorse is only a redemptive thing if it motivates us to turn back to God. So when Jesus says, your sins are forgiven, he doesn't say just that. He says, go and sin no more. He doesn't say, your sins are forgiven, now feel really bad, because that's what makes God happy. Amazingly, when we have been forgiven and we repent, our regrets no longer need to have power over us. And this is what he's getting at in verse 10. Godly sorrow brings repentance that leads to salvation and leaves no regret. Paul says that this is because of our salvation. When our sins have been forgiven through Christ's work on the cross, we have been completely released from the sorrow of our past mistakes, even if we still suffer from the consequences of those past mistakes. He's declaring to us we no longer have to live in a state of regret. Because through Christ, you've been declared innocent. God no longer holds that over you. And a large part of the Christian life is actually agreeing with God about that. About what God has already said about us, that we're accepted. So the pop cliche that we have been talking about tonight, have no regrets, is true for Christians, but in a specific sense that the pop songs don't mean. Paul does not mean, just don't think too much about your mistakes, because it will inhibit your freedom to feel how you want to feel right now. That's not what having no regrets is about, biblically. No, he's saying, think about your past mistakes, be forgiven for them, turn back to God, and enter into the true freedom of the gospel, in which all your mistakes have been accounted for, and you're still embraced. That's the freedom of the gospel. So even if we do have regrets, there's something we need to work on. They're not something that God is imposing on us. That's basically where I want to end. I think this passage in 2 Corinthians is an example to me of one of the ways in which our emotions can function properly in order to lead us back to God, in order to actually remind us of the truth. But it's when they're in their proper place. Paul isn't encouraging the Corinthians to make their emotions God. I'm going to end with one last song without a lot of commentary, although I'll just say, this is a song that a student this term recommended to me, and I went and heard, and also one of our helpers, Chloe, has recommended it to me also, by an artist named Sia. It's called Chandelier. It's a really powerful song, I think. It has similar themes to a lot of the things we've been talking about, but to me, to my ears, has a very different tone, and it's a much more honest tone. It's a tone of desperation, so this is not a happy song, even though I suppose you could listen to it without really focusing much on the words. This to me is a bit more honest. We'll listen to it.
Nope, sorry, it's not that. You don't even listen to that again. What is love? Don't get hurt, can't understand. And what I learned, I push it down.
to me, this is the end of the lecture, but I'll just say one thing. A lot of the same things that I've identified as cliches come up in this song, but it's not celebrated. Right. The whole image of swinging from the chandelier, which is this image of sort of reckless abandon. I'm just going to party, it's going to be great, I'm not going to think about tomorrow. It becomes clear if you listen to the song, this is, I'm holding on by my fingernails. I can't look down. I'm just holding on barely. Mm-hmm. In the context of really, I don't know, depression and seemingly alcoholism, it's about just drinking yourself into a place of oblivion. And, living like tomorrow doesn't exist. But it's not, yay, tomorrow doesn't exist. It's coping with the present emptiness somehow. And I think it's quite an honest song in a way that a lot of the other ones you've been listening to aren't really. But that's where I'm going to end, and this is the way it works here. I know I've gone very long, but the way it works here is that we open it up for discussion or questions or comments. Anybody who needs to leave should feel free to duck out. That's fine. But I'll talk for a little while. We'll discuss for a little while longer, and then my voice will probably give out. So. Any thoughts?
Yeah, kind of going up, yeah. Like contrasting this song from some of the other ones. Like I'm kind of of the opinion that artistically, like I think there's a lot of merit in hearing songs from the perspective of a character that is engaged in something that can show a context, even if like the writer isn't intending that. I think as a Christian, it can be very healthy for us to engage with that and to be able to thank God that that's not how we have to live.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, like I also think that like the idea of writing a song from the perspective of an unreliable narrator, that you know, I mean, and like obviously there's something in. I think there's a different level of artistry that's going on in a kid's set that than what's normally going to be played on radio.
Exactly, yeah.
And so I don't know if you have any perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. I the assumption a lot of pop music is that the singer's heart is on their sleeve. It's autobiographical. This is me singing about my heart to you. If you think of the majority of love songs that actually create a persona or a character and sort of sing from the perspective of that character are very often, I think, misunderstood and don't actually get a lot of radio play. the example in my mind, and this is a you know, he's ancient, but Randy Newman, he is a master at the unreliable narrator as a perspective of a song. So he creates a persona, he creates a character, and he just sings the song from that person's perspective without any clarification of, you know, this isn't really me, this isn't really Randy Newman's opinion, this is, you know, so-and-so. It's just, here it is. And no matter how offensive and dysfunctional and abusive that character is. And, you know, he's been misunderstood for a long time at various different times in his life because of, you know, a lot of things he wrote. But I think there's a huge, I think it's a quality of writing which is a step above most of what we hear on this, which demands real careful listening. But I think it's, I think sort of the sort of unexamined assumption out there is that sort of pop love songs and stuff are just, yeah, it's autobiographical. It's not like you're creating a character in the same way that a short story writer would create a character and get away with it. You know, like anyway. Yeah.
One more thing on that. I think there's also a difference between like the idea of authenticity being that it's my, I ought to follow what my heart wants to do, and writing from a perspective of this is what my heart led me to do, you know, and writing, like, there's a difference between, like, authenticity as honesty and almost confessional type of writing rather than authenticity as an ideal that as in the way that you were describing.
Right.
And I assume that, but yeah, it's unfortunate that I think a lot of radio pop music doesn't explore stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I think there's a way to write about the same things that, from an honest perspective.
Yeah.
That's probably closer to something like this, where this is probably the experience a lot of people have, and I think writing about things that, like, from a personal perspective, becomes pretty universal. I think it's important to express those kinds of things
mm-hmm.
for no other reason than to, like, point to the fact that there's an emptiness to it.
Yeah, and she, and since she's not like, the song is not moralistic. It's saying a bunch of stuff about how she lives her life, but then it's kind of pointing you in the direction of the consequences of it, I guess. And not clarifying. I think that's one of the reasons why it's a strong song. But it sounds.
Touching on asking, you're saying that the other song, the earlier song, is going to live the way she wants to, and telling her boyfriend or whatever in the way she wants to, and let you go because that's the way I feel. But it's not. It's saying, in effect, there really is no tomorrow, and above all, we won't have to reap what we sow. We won't have to pay for our,
mm-hmm.
our sins. Tomorrow doesn't exist. But here is rather different, really. I'm going to live like there's no tomorrow, but yet, at the same time, she's saying, I know there is tomorrow. I mean, I'm not going to have to pay.
Yeah.
Pay for my things. I'm not going to have to reap what I've sown.
Yeah.
Tomorrow morning, I'm a mess.
Well, the song actually describes what happens the next day, which is unusual. Yeah, I think you're right.
It was unusual.
It's unusual, and then it actually describes what happens the next day. I mean, in a sense, it's a loose narrative, but actually talks about.
Denied all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Abba, do you okay?
Yeah, like two questions. Where I think one of the challenges in, I guess, trying to engage other people in pop music
mm-hmm.
that almost to what this is saying, it's not saying tomorrow is going to be rough,
yeah.
so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
It's almost saying, like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, 1, 2, 3, drink,
yeah.
and tomorrow's going to be rough, okay?
Yeah.
And that's just my life. Almost
yeah.
like the Taylor Swift song, where it's like, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm going to meet you, we'll talk for a month, man.
Yeah.
You're going to break my heart, I'm going to hate your guts.
It's going to go down in flames, but we do it anyway. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
You know, so it's almost like there's no. So I think, like, that's, I don't know if you have any thoughts on how would you engage past that. Because I feel like, and sometimes even if you point out to somebody to say, like, well, one, did you even listen to what the word said?
Yeah.
They're like, what are you talking about?
yeah, exactly.
They went out to get a drink, and they were playing Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's exactly right.
Oh, is that what it, that was it? So, like, sometimes it's
yeah.
I'm so aloof to even what the words are saying that, like, it's all what's wrong with you? So, like, you read the words?
You went online and found the words and that song. You're what a loser. Yeah. I mean, this is a dilemma to me. And I was hinting that in the beginning of the lecture. That you know, this stuff really does affect us, even if we're not listening, even if we're not focusing on the lyrics. But you know, it's possible that many of these songs just go in one ear and out the other, and it doesn't. I mean, like a lot of people love a particular song and have no idea what the words even are. But that's one of the aspects of what pop radio does.
Yeah, well,
they are designed to be that way.
Do you have any thoughts on how to push people beyond that? I think that's one of the major. It's almost like, I was having a Kendrick Lamar came out with the album, mm-hmm. and people thought like he was really saying something, and it was like too deep.
Uh-huh.
Please don't do that. Drake came out with the album at the same time, but it was like. So I was having an argument with two of my friends here. One person was like, "Are you crazy? Of course I love Kendrick Lamar's album because that can say something."
Yeah.
And the other guy was saying, "Look. there are times where I don't even want to hear what he has to say because it's just making me think too much.
Yeah.
I want to put on Drake's album,
mm-hmm.
go to the club, drink,
yeah.
have a good time, and then go home.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's almost like, almost what you were saying about being in the mood. It's almost like, look, I'm putting on all these songs because I am actually constantly trying to escape reality.
Yeah, distraction.
Without
yeah.
nothing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm angry. It's Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
I've had a long week.
Yeah.
I want to go get a drink.
Yeah.
I don't want you talking.
I
want
to get Blotto. Listen to yeah.
Give me three lines. Like you do like this.
Yeah. And that, I mean that it's two totally different functions of music. One of which is something to really chew on and reflect and think about, and the other is escape and distraction. And,
right.
and yeah.
For me, it's like a lot of positive, a lot of. And he actually, so he said. He was like, you know, Kendrick Lamar put out a concert album,
yeah.
and then Drake put out a club banger. And that's what he called it. Give me a club banger to go and enjoy
yeah.
myself.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, I feel like there's a challenge in trying to, you know, get you to actually engage,
yeah.
think about it, and say, hey, you know, you think that you can have 10 relationships in a year, you know, and even if you even would suggest. Maybe it's because Taylor Swift got in your mind. And like, what are you talking about?
No.
like,
no. Yeah.
You know, like
no. I don't think it doesn't really come down to this pop song told me to do this. Now I'm gonna go do this.
Yeah,
it's much more just like the climate of this.
No,
the substance we're breathing. Yeah.
It's in the climate.
Yeah.
of the culture. But it's like, how do you communicate that?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I mean, your friend the one at the club banger would have hated this lecture because we've done a lot of.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been a lot of thinking about stuff you're not supposed to think about, right?
Yeah.
I think my hunch is that it's very, very hard to just in words tell somebody that their approach should be different because they have to come to some sort of point of being disillusioned with waking up the next day being hungover
yeah,
and
yeah,
wondering
yeah.
who that is in the bed next to me. You know, like
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
there has to be some disenchantment. You know, with that, and you can't make someone be disenchanted necessarily if that's how they. But I mean, it's to me a valid thing to ask. Well, is this how you view living your life? I mean, does this give you a sense of meaning?
Yeah, yeah.
And significance.
Yeah.
And could there be something more or not?
Yeah.
That may not be a conversation you could have with depending on where your friend's at. But
and I think that the other challenge is. Like a lot of pop music or like popular music is that is what's cool.
Yeah.
And you coming from, you know, another side and trying to critique it,
yeah.
you're automatically putting yourself in an uncool
yeah.
type of way. So it's
yes.
like you know, my like you're dull, boring, lame, unimaginative, you know, prude, any other word that
yeah.
I can say that's not cool and attractive.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So everything you're saying to me is like, even if you're making sense and you're quote unquote rational,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And it's not touching me to a place to say, oh man, maybe I should think about my life and really like not do this anymore. So like, would you please shut up?
yeah.
I mean, like, so I feel like that's
the best comment I've ever had in my life.
Oh, really?
I know, right?
you know,
yeah.
That's why I think it's great to try to communicate it.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be a lot of the major challenges.
Yeah. I mean, you're never gonna make somebody stop treating pop music as just entertainment if that's what they want to, if that's the, what they want it to be in their life.
Yeah.
Like, no, you should listen to the words. You hear that? But, I mean, my wife, when she was young in high school, had this Beastie Boys album, and she was all into it, and she was in her car, and she was giving her dad a ride somewhere, because he needed a ride, and he said, do you know what they're talking about? It's, you know, I don't even know what song it was, but it's about some violent sexual act.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And she was undone. Obviously, this is her dad talking to her, so it's always not just, you know, two random friends at a club,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
discussing lyrics. But he said, are you listening to what you're, like, grooving to? Like,
yeah,
what is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she wasn't. She hadn't. And then she did. and she was mortified. And so it's not. I think it's. I hesitate to raise your hopes for that you're gonna get these people to listen to the vacuous nature of pop music and then want to change their lives.
Yeah.
But there's very likely other inroads with people. You know, what about your relationships that you actually really do care about, and why do you screw them up? there's a million other things other than, I don't feel like I'm on a crusade to make people analyze pop music necessarily. But I think it's good. But I think probably it'd be better if more of us thought about what we were just like, yeah. I know you are. I know you. Anyway, yeah. It's a good question.
Yeah, Megan. Something about the availability of all of the media that we have washing over us all the time has numbed us in a lot of ways, and we're just used to inputting stuff into our life all the time. You turn on the TV and it's in the background.
Yeah.
You turn on the music and it's just always there. And I feel like the problem that, in this regard, that Christian subculture has taken is they realize what's being thrown at them, and so rather than thinking critically about what they're actually taking in, they just decide, nope, I'm going to shut out culture, and I'm going to listen to only Christian.
Do a Christian version of the same thing.
It's the same kind of trope.
Yeah.
Holier ones, and you don't actually think about it. And so rather than making the hard choice to actually analyze the fire hydrant that we're trying to drink from, the media, we say, I can't do that. But I know I shouldn't listen to this Beastie Boys or whatever, and so I just mindlessly take in whatever CCM tells me to take in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think the other, like, going to what you were saying about the, I think just culture at large has lost a lot of, well, the analysis, like, the collective analysis engine or whatever has kind of shifted to, away from art and to more so, like, I don't know exactly what it's shifted to, but, like, there's still, like, we live in a highly analytical culture, but that doesn't seem to feel the need to, like, specifically analyze, like, art. So, like,
it's shifted to what sells.
So, like, the
to what can just go in.
So there's, and also I think it's that art has been relegated to instead of something that's supposed to be a reflection and something that we consider and that might change us, it's supposed to just be an accessory and an aesthetic in our life.
Yeah.
So that we identify and we get a lot of our identity from what we associate with what art we're associated with.
Yeah.
Rather than looking at something as a piece of art and saying, okay, what does this tell me about myself? What does this tell me about the world around me? What does this tell me about God?
There's a million things going on there, but I think it's really true. There's a loss of a sense that there's actually the intention of the artist matters.
Yeah.
It's just whatever, however I choose to use it, and however I'm, so it's kind of the viewer has the authority to interpret however they want. I think it's that combined with a consumer attitude that art is something I consume. It's not something that is necessarily is robust enough to critique me. And it's also, like you said, a significant part of our identity. How often when we think about, well, I think our taste is a huge part of how we feel legitimate. You know, and I think in the context of music, it's one of the most extreme things. Like, I'm not one of those people that is into this mainstream crap. Like, I like this esoteric band that nobody's heard of because they're so awesome. And that can be a huge part of my identity and what makes me feel superior to everybody else.
Yeah.
And so that's all of those things are not actually treating art as art that can maybe speak to me. It's using it for different purposes. Using it to consume. Using it to create social hierarchies about who has the best taste. Which is sad. I mean, I think I'm certainly guilty of that at times, and I probably appreciate art less because of it. Do you want to come back on that? I mean, I'm sort of rambling at this point. Yeah, Peter.
You mentioned neuromanticism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see how it supports Victorianism? Do you see that present in pop music, or the examples I was thinking in particular? I know this is outside of the parameters of your lecture, but thinking in particular of actually country and rap mm-hmm. music that have a lot of neo-Victorian aspects. But do you see that?
Can you tell me what you mean? In terms of just materialism,
yeah,
like money?
Yeah, so it's a little bit vague, right? Yeah. So, as opposed to neo-romanticism, which is I just feel, and that's mm-hmm. defines who I am, neo-Victorian being, yeah, something more related to whether it's material goods or even sort of ideals, and it's kind of like these are morals or values.
Mm.
And if given our culture, right, like they don't look like what Christians would necessarily say are morals, but there's some sort of ideal that I am this good person because I did this or...
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good question.
I just thought it was interesting that neo-romanticism, it's just like, it's mostly about feelings and mm-hmm. being, I treat myself and love, and mm-hmm. It's making billions of dollars.
Who are new Victorians.
Yeah,
the CEOs are.
Who are totally know how to milk, how to make money off it, how to package it. Even Taylor Swift's, the video you played has a sponsor, right, from Nokia or something. And you
I forget what it was. Yeah.
Something different to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I believe Starbucks paid her to make it sound like
I would not be surprised. It sounds remarkably like Starbucks.
It is.
Is it?
It's even the nature of pop music. It pushes something. It's being sold to us literally in some way. So it is always, there's probably some cold hearted statistician, I don't know, engineer type somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe not. But anyway, I thought it was...
It's good to get away from the assumption that all this pop music we listen to is these individual artists writing songs about their lives. I mean, these songs are written by a group of people.
Professional
songwriters who are going to sell this song, and some of them even work for a recording company or whatever, and... You know, which artist is going to sing it? Who's going to pick this one up?
Yeah.
Or writing for a particular singer, and so it's very, very calculated.
Yeah.
And
former folk singer that came out funny. Named Dashboard Confessional, who's like friends with Taylor Swift. He's been out of the scene for five or six years as a phenomenon. But I saw an interview with him because Taylor Swift had him come to her best friend's birthday party, mm-hmm. so she. Like tweeted it or made a Vine or something of it,
mm-hmm.
and so all of a sudden, Dashboard Confessional has the Taylor Swift stamp of approval, and he was like, "I make more money writing songs for other people. So even though maybe I don't look as cool because I'm connected to Taylor Swift, I have more jobs writing songs now. Because of the Taylor Swift bump.
So
it's just
I believe it. Yeah.
To Peter's question,
I
was really struck by the idol of youth in this, and even that whatever teenage
King Curry
song. And I was just thinking about how the romantics, along with really emphasizing feeling as the location for authenticity, there was a really... just a huge emphasis on childhood and the holiness almost of childhood.
Purity,
The purity of children have these unmediated experiences of the divine because they hadn't been, corrupted yet
by
the world.
Yeah.
They came to the defense of children who were being, put into work as chimney sweeps and all that.
Yeah.
Good side of that.
Yeah.
But, so I was thinking how, but this isn't... childhood. Like, it's not the glory of childhood.
No.
It's like party, college.
Physical beauty.
Old enough to have sex, but and be totally reckless.
Yeah.
But not old enough to be held to account yet, and particularly in a society where like we have this extended adolescence, and people don't have to sort of be responsible for their lives yet.
Not old enough to be made ugly by your choices.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you're still young, so you can still do really stupid stuff and still, you know.
So, I mean, even what you were saying, Amba, like, part of me wants to say, like, is it wrong to say that you should grow out of pop music? Like, if you don't grow out of this, aren't you resisting, like, a good maturing that should be happening, and you know, if you kind of keep.
That's why country music is there. Go to listen to country music. The New Victorians. it's a good question.
I was thinking about.
Yeah, I don't know.
I played 22,
and
I
played
something that
Ina
has, but I mean, Taylor Swift's only like
21 or
23.
She's
26
now.
Yeah.
So 22 is way back there for her.
That album is old enough that she's talking about.
Yeah, I know exactly. Red, so yeah.
I mean, she could have easily written the song when she was 22. You know, so it's like she's even creating. I mean, the song says, like, we're going to live like we're 22. I mean, that would be like somebody my age being like, I'm going to live like I'm 22, but you've got somebody who's actually 22.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
that's interesting, yeah. Because I think maybe is part of her genius, is because she is appealing to young kids who aren't even yet 22. Mm-hmm. But she's also appealing to older people that remember when they were 22 and how awesome it was. Mm-hmm. And she herself is right around that age. So it actually doesn't make a lot of sense for her to be saying like we're 22, you know, but she is selling, right? Very very effectively. Remind me your name again. I'm sorry,
John.
Yeah.
I noticed the contrast between when we're looking at lyrics on the screen and writing and hearing music, as opposed to the video.
Oh yeah.
The extra dimension.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a big part of what's going on, you know, the generation listens to the music on the radio while they're going somewhere, but they've seen the video and they're able to find that. And then you add the dimension of alcohol and drugs, like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you mentioned some of the negative effects that, you know, so many women have been cheated on or one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
You also imagine the party spirit of getting drunk, getting crazy, and driving.
Yeah.
And many deaths and injuries and that kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
The Bible says that the thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of agendas involved besides making a lot of money that they were talking about.
Yeah.
A lot of agendas that different folks have in the process. That,
yeah.
Kids just listen to it more or less innocently and they're living for the weekend.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So this is kind of something they could just, like you said, the catchy tune and not even realize. They may catch a little phrase in the whole song that they can identify with.
Yeah.
And the rest of the lyrics might not even really understand.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true. And that's one of the things that makes me a little just worried about the sinister aspect of some of this stuff. To me, the Katy Perry song that I quoted here was really bothers me. There's other Katy Perry songs that I think are more harmless, but that one is like, because it's so clearly written to young preteen kids. Like, her whole persona, everything she does, is a little girly kind of, even though she's not a little girl. And the song is so explicit. and I think that's an example of what I was talking about at the beginning, how it's whether we like it or not, whether we pay attention to every lyric or not, it is giving us a picture of what normal is.
Well, it's also like little
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I know. And, yeah, exactly, yeah. But that's... Yeah. Yeah, and that's it's got to be catchy. If it's, I think one of the things, this is a different issue, but one of the things that annoys me so much about, I sense this more on listening to country music, contemporary country music, is the, it is so formulaic. It's all formulaic, but country music is, it's, there's so obviously a hook, which is the chorus, to sell the song, and then everything else is completely secondary. So, like, the verse, in terms of developing some sort of, developing anything, you know, throughout the verses, and then the, the verses are just an excuse to get back to the hook, again and again and again. And in the Katy Perry song, it's the line about "Let's go all the way tonight," you know, no regrets, just love, you know, and that's the hook. That's the line that sticks in your head and sells the song. And songwriters are very, very conscious of that. And that's, had you have a good hook, then you can sell the song. So.
What is good, though, too, is when a Christian song develops a good song,
mm-hmm.
lyrics, music, whether they do both or, you know, collaborate
mm-hmm.
with the music. And it has that same effect in positive,
mm-hmm.
which you don't hear too often
yeah.
on pop radio.
No, you wouldn't.
But there is good music out there like that.
Yeah.
Blessed by it.
I think the thing that I long to see more of, and I think it exists, but I long to see thoughtful Christians, or I long to hear thoughtful Christians writing music that is not immediately categorizable as Christian. Depending on how explicit you are with the Christian content in a song, it can be a guarantee that no one is going to listen to it that doesn't already agree with you.
They're curious and they say, "Hey, yeah. what do they mean by that?"
Yeah, or you know, I think sometimes the best thing that a Christian songwriter can do is write something that's provocative and leaves people walking away like, huh. I think because very often you say more, and we're already just talking to Christians, and I think, but that's obviously a really, really hard thing to do. I mean, to try to in some plausible way that isn't immediately dismissed as sentimental and kitsch or whatever, to try to present some positive picture of what goodness is in art, whether it's in filmmaking or whatever, is really, really challenging. It's much easier to be cynical, right? But I think that's something like what Christian artists are called to. Abba and then Megan. Yeah.
I think whether it's, you know, the music is showing what the mindset is, or the music is creating the mindset. Mm. You know, like the culture.
Mm.
Like, do you have any thoughts on that? I guess. Because that's the dominant mindset, some of the things you were showing, like, you know, what you feel is your identity, and
mm-hmm.
you know, like being authentic. You have ways of trying to push back or challenge that, right? Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is hard to do that in an essay or
mm-hmm.
in one way, but like, I don't know if there's any artistic ways to try to challenge that as well.
Mm-hmm. You mean pop music as an instructor, and how are there any ways to be instructed in different directions?
Like, so it's almost like, you know, what you were saying, pop music, this is the doctrine, and then these are the preachers.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You are enforcing the doctrine.
Yeah.
Right, so then how do you, is there a way to counteract?
A lot of it has to do with what we fill our minds with and get. I mean, there are alternative pictures of what is good and beautiful. We might not find them on pop radio, but I think, and that's one of the reasons that it's not just about, it's not just about being afraid of how pop music will influence me, because it is an instructor, and so I'm going to avoid this, or hate it, or dismiss it, or whatever. I'm all for listening to something, but not as a consumer, just listening to it and trying to reflect on it thoughtfully. But then also, because I am susceptible to swallow all this stuff I'm hearing, because it connects with my heart, it's not just like making arguments to me, I need to be giving myself alternative pictures of what is good and beautiful. And that can be in all different kinds of ways, I think. I think we're probably more likely to get it through literature than pop music. Or different kinds of music other than top 40 pop radio, maybe. But it does require an effort to do that. If we live on a diet solely of club music or something, then we shouldn't expect to hear anything different. I don't know. Any other thoughts on that? I mean, there's so much. There's a lot. I mean, it's almost like there's too much, I think, in some ways. There's a lecture here last term was it last term? Or the one before, about reading novels as a spiritual discipline. And it was really helpful, but it was one of the things she was talking about was giving us plausible, non-sentimental pictures of what goodness could look like that actually grab our imagination and aren't preachy and say, well, you know, a good person does this and this and this and not that. You know, that doesn't actually connect with us, you know. But if it's a really good novel that actually, over the course of a whole narrative, paints this picture of someone who is good and attractive because they're good, right?
I think one of the challenges as Christians, and like people could be looking at it from an artist's perspective, is that like what I think started off as a group of people that were attempting to kind of be subversive within the culture and mm-hmm. and try to kind of co-opt what I think they saw as a destructive trend in popular music, ended up creating an alternative industry that's doing the exact same thing,
mm-hmm.
but also tarnished the idea that someone from a Christian perspective could bring anything artistic to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it becomes almost doubly hard to be a Christian and be an artist because you first have to prove that you have something to say besides, like, you have to, like, get past the idea that, okay, I believe in God, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing this specific thing that someone, you almost have to, I think if there's an Emily Dickinson poem, mm-hmm. but, like, tell the truth until it's slant,
mm-hmm.
the idea that you can't, like, the heart can't necessarily hear something
mm-hmm.
That isn't veiled in something else to mm-hmm. So, like, I think part of the idea of being a Christian and an artist is that you have to make sure that the art that you're making is, like, incredibly good.
Mm-hmm.
For that, and that almost has to be more of a testament than the mm-hmm. art itself, I think, in this day and age. But, like,
yeah.
The content of the art, unfortunately, has to sometimes be secondary to the fact that, oh, like, this guy actually cares about what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't just, because the problem is that, as you alluded to, like, in the Christian subculture idea, the people that are writing the Christian songs are oftentimes writing them because they know that Christians will buy them.
There's a ready-made market for that, yeah.
And it's almost easier because if you, you know, talk about, if you use the word Christian and talk about anything but a person, it's just a marketing term. Like,
mm-hmm.
the idea that it's a way that you know that anyone who trusts that fountain of things mm-hmm. is going to just buy it without
sure.
even thinking about it.
Yeah.
Which I think also alters people's views of God because it's a watered down version of his too, a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're going back to what you said a minute ago about the quality of art has to be really, really good. To me, that's not just a matter of, in order to be taken seriously as a Christian, I need to make something that is of such a high quality. It may be true, but that should be our goal anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually how we honor God as artists, is to make really, really good, if we can. And so I think the danger, I think, out of a very well-intentioned concern for the gospel and for evangelism and for more people to come to Christ, the danger for a long time has been to make the art itself simply a means to that end, so a means to evangelism in some way, which means either it's very explicit about Christian content or it is in a creepy way subversive, but obvious what's happening anyway. And I think to me that ends up being sort of a withered view of what the vocation of the artist is, which is, you know, before God as a way of honoring God and as my worship to Him, I'm going to try to produce a good work of art, regardless of whether it, at the end of the day, converts somebody or not. And actually, the sad irony, I think of the sad irony, is that art that is produced really for the purpose of evangelism, art that has sort of a Christian bow or a Christian moral sort of on the end, it's like, this is what it's about, you know, both suffers as art. It's not really taken seriously by people who care about art, because it's not good. It's closer to propaganda. It's telling you exactly what you're supposed to think, which is what propaganda does. Art usually has some level of ambiguity to it, which enables you to enter into it and think about it, right? So, but if it's just that, then it both suffers as art, but it also is useless as evangelism. Because what non-Christian is going to go and embrace this clearly Christian message if they're turned off, if they're already turned off by it? I mean, so it only, a lot of the attempts to sort of do art for evangelism are only encouragement to people who are already Christians. And they sort of use it as devotion,
yeah,
rather than actually communicating to somebody who doesn't.
It turns an influence. So like, all you're thinking about that, and you might try and show it to friends, but they're just gonna like pass it off as poor art or
feel manipulated.
Yeah.
And that's it's not that it's poorly motivated, and we really should be caring about people hearing the gospel. But the question is, how do we communicate effectively? Out of love for people, how do we communicate effectively? I think it's an analogous to the whole discussion of apologetics in general, that we don't just give people the good news of the gospel who don't think that sin is a problem. You know, like, we actually have to understand what they think and where they're coming from before we can even begin to judge what they might hear and understand. Anyway. Peter.
This is kind of informed, so it's out there, but is it plausible that, as opposed to being a tyranny of feelings, it's actually a tyranny of erotic love? In the sense that an erotic love is inherently just about feelings and emotions and how you literally, like, what you physically are experiencing at that moment. Because almost all of these, with the exception of Don't Change Your Plans, are geared towards the fulfillment is my sexual desire.
Yeah.
And not necessarily, like, they're not exploring the range of emotions as far as anger and whatnot. Like, they're not, there's a whole other range of emotions and feelings that aren't really explored in here.
Yeah.
It's only either the positive or the negative side of erotic love. And maybe that
part of that is the genre we're looking at. Like, the sub music which focuses on anger more often.
Yeah. That being an unfair question, but
So are you suggesting that it's not so much tyranny of emotions, but it's erotic love, which is the basis for that, whether it's positive or negative?
Yeah, so that there's
may be true, but
right. So like, it's fine to necessarily maybe have a tyranny. I mean, tyranny is inherently negative, but a dominance of emotions, but not necessarily like erotic love is the only emotion, right? Because, like, I'm trying to think of a song that is, like, rational, right? That, like, I would like. I don't know, like, it just seems inherently out of whack. And maybe I need to just, like, look at songs I like more, or something's whack with me, but, like, right? It seems inherently, like, a song has to be emotional in it. And, in fact, it has to be kind of the elevated part of it. Certainly not, like, if I wanted to make my life decisions, I would want to be only emotional.
It doesn't necessarily. I mean, a lot of good music that I like to listen to is not emotional in the performance, and in the sense, it's you know, there's such a thing as a deadpan performance.
Okay.
Which is, but it's not, that's not to say that therefore it's just rational.
Okay.
It can be, there can be all kinds of things going on metaphorically. And I mean, one of my favorite singers is Gillian Welch. She writes really good songs, I think. But does not tell you how you, does not indicate to you how you're supposed to feel about the song by her performance. So this is one of the things, okay, that I think I feel manipulated when I hear someone singing who the song is kind of crappy, but the performance is telling me how emotional I'm supposed to feel. And to me, she actually sings most of her songs in an almost sort of deadpan way, but her songwriting is so good that the song actually hits me. And her, like, you know, she's not, you know, weeping and straining her voice and trying to indicate to me how I'm supposed to feel, but I find her songs emotionally powerful, very powerful sometimes, and more so because she's not trying to manipulate me.
Well,
I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Part of what I think goes back to this is his idea of the simplification of the self, specifically sexuality. I mean, that is like the identifier that we're dealing with in all kinds of different cultures. I'm completely like in the idea that the romantic relationship is what ultimately satisfies the person. That is the core of what it is to, like, once I have some sort of attainable thing in that, that's what's going to satisfy me, right? So, I mean, you get a lot of songs that are written in that regard because that's everyone's default.
Yeah.
Just to think that's what's going to.
That's what all of our longings are leading to. Yeah. Well, that's true. But I mean, some of the stuff that I was quote, I didn't, maybe not what we were listening to, but songs that I quoted are not so much about erotic love as much as they are.
Yeah, they're thinking about American Authors.
American Authors one, and even the Hurt one. You know, there is a romantic element in that song, but it's about. That first verse is so like brutal.
Yeah.
Like, I hurt myself to, you know, the only thing that's real.
Yeah. But I think when Johnny Cash sings it, it takes on a completely different.
Yeah.
Like, there's this double meaning thing behind the entire thing.
Yeah.
Because
his version is better.
Oh yeah. But it's also like you almost have to know his whole life story.
Yeah.
And then that,
which the video sort of hints at a lot of it. Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I would even say, like, I think the Ben Folds song
operates
more on the level of, like, I don't know if it's an autobiographical or not, but at the same time, I don't think
he's
necessarily making it, this is the right thing that I'm doing. Like, I think there is an element of regret in that song.
Yeah, but it, to me, it's the word that kept coming to my mind is wistful. It's kind of like he's resigned to it. And it's sad, but he's not questioning it.
That's how I see it, as like he has created this other persona of this person who does this all the time, and how they must view their life, because he probably sees people like that.
Sure, and it's possible that it's satire. That's possible too. Maybe it's the unreliable narrator kind of thing. With it, this is, I'm just stating something that is, I'm actually trying to highlight the absurdity of this. I love you, goodbye.
Yeah.
Like, what do you, maybe it is.
Yeah.
I hope it is.
Yeah.
It actually makes, it's a way better song if it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like the satirical songs are, like, it's a little bit clearer, like, when he's sort of, like, when, like, you know, they're doing that kind of, like, they have, like, a kind of a character as part of it, but even the title of the song, like, that seems a bit more, like, clearly, like, he's owning that in some way.
He's not a super soul.
I was going to say, like, Chen Wei, she has a really interesting video to it. Like,
it's the dancing kid. Yeah.
It's, like, this dark, decrepit, like, apartment.
This little kid, I chose not to show the video because I thought it was, in a sense, too distracting from the. I mean, powerful, but not necessarily illuminating to the words. It was, I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, I'm going to stop. Thank you for staying to the bitter end, everybody.